If you love to travel, Capital One has a rewards credit card that's perfect for you. With the Capital One Venture X card, you earn unlimited double miles on everything you buy. Plus, you get premium benefits at a collection of luxury hotels when you book on Capital One Travel. And with Venture X, you get access to over 1,000 airport lounges worldwide. Open up a world of travel possibilities with the Capital One Venture X card. What's in your wallet?
Terms apply. Lounge access is subject to change. See CapitalOne.com for details.
Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we are plunging into an absolutely wild ancient text. It takes us on this incredible journey, heavenly realms, earthly chaos, divine judgment, cosmic secrets, the works.
Yeah, our source for this deep dive is a text known as Enos Journeys, Fallen Angels, Judgment, and Visions. It's a really unique look at some foundational ideas, but from a perspective that's, you know, outside the more familiar biblical stuff.
Exactly. And our mission, our goal for this deep dive, to really unpack the core story and these, frankly, astonishing details from this text, trying to understand its dramatic take on where evil comes from, the consequences, mm-hmm. and the structure of, well, everything spiritual, physical, all through Enoch's eyes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's dig in, get ready for rebellious angels, terrifying giants, these sort of cosmic prisons and visions that span the whole universe. It's quite a ride.
It really is.
Yeah.
And the text opens with a scene that just, it grabs you immediately. It sets up this really dramatic origin story, describes how, you know, as humanity multiplied on Earth, a group of angels, they're called the Children of the Heaven, or Watchers, saw something.
The Daughters of Men.
Exactly. They saw the Daughters of Men were beautiful, which, for an angel, shouldn't have really registered like that.
Right. And it wasn't just like, oh, nice. No, they lusted after them. And the text says they actually conferred, come, let us choose us wives from among the children of men and beget us children. It's a conscious decision to cross a huge cosmic line.
But interestingly, it wasn't just, you know, let's do it immediately. Their leader, Semjaza, he actually voices this fear. He's worried, apparently, that he alone would end up bearing the penalty for this, well, massive sin, if the others chickened out.
Which tells you they knew, they absolutely knew this was a huge transgression. But instead of backing down, they
double down, exactly. The others respond by swearing a mutual oath, binding themselves by what the text calls mutual imprecations, basically cursing themselves if they backed out of the plan.
Wow, and they did this somewhere specific.
Yep, all 200 of them came down in the days of Jared onto the top of Mount Hermon. And the source is really explicit here. They named it Mount Hermon because that's where they swore this oath. The location itself is marked by their rebellion.
And it even lists the leaders, right? The chiefs of tens.
It does. Samazaz, Orichalba, Ramiel. It's quite a list. It really emphasizes that this was an organized, you know, deliberate move by a pretty significant chunk of these watchers.
Okay. So they take wives, they defile themselves, as the text says. But that wasn't the end of it, was it? This is where it gets like really weird and maybe even more damaging.
Absolutely. It wasn't just about the physical act. It was about transmitting forbidden knowledge. The text goes into detail about what these fallen watchers started teaching humanity.
They had like charms and enchantments.
Yeah. Semjaza and others taught those.
Yeah.
Cutting roots, knowledge of plants, things that sound maybe like, you know, magic or forbidden herbalism.
And others taught other specific things.
Oh, yeah. Breaks it down. Barakiel taught astrology. Kokabel, the constellations. Ezekiel about clouds. Eraquiel, signs of the earth. Shemziel, signs of the sun. Serial, the course of the moon.
Mm.
And Armaros taught how to resolve enchantments. So you get this whole spectrum from outright magical stuff to like cosmic knowledge that humans weren't supposed to have access to, or maybe not in that way.
What does that list feel like to you? Astrology, signs of the sun and moon. It's like they're giving humanity ways to maybe predict or manipulate things outside the divine plan, circumventing God, perhaps.
That's a great way to put it. Yeah, revealing secrets, things meant to be hidden, or maybe only known through God. But it wasn't just knowledge causing problems. This union, it had physical consequences too. And they were, well, monstrous.
Oh, yeah. The giants, the offspring of the angels and human women. The text calls them great giants.
And it gives a height. 3,000 ells. Now, translating that is tricky, but it suggests something utterly enormous, maybe thousands of feet tall, just terrifyingly unnatural in scale.
Unbelievable. And these weren't gentle giants, were they?
Not at all. They apparently consumed everything humans had stored up, all the food, all the resources. And when that ran out,
they turned on humans.
Devouring them, yes.
Yeah.
And then it got even worse. The giants started sinning against animals too. Birds, beasts, reptiles, fish, consuming flesh, drinking blood, just total unrestrained violence and consumption, corrupting the whole natural order.
To the point where the earth cries out.
Exactly. The text says the earth laid accusation against the lawless ones. Like creation itself couldn't bear it.
And beyond the giants, there was one watcher, Azazel, who taught particularly nasty stuff.
Right. He singled out, he taught humans how to make weapons, swords, knives, shields, breastplates, how to work metals, basically introducing sophisticated warfare.
But he also taught makeup.
Yeah.
And jewelry.
Yeah. Bracelets, ornaments, using antimony for eyeliner, costly stones, dyes. It's fascinating that the text puts weapon making right next to cosmetics.
What do you make of that pairing?
Well, maybe it suggests corruption isn't just about violence. It's also about, you know, vanity, maybe deception, focusing on the external rather than inner righteousness, leading people astray through superficial things as well as weapons.
That makes sense. So the combined effect is just chaos, much godlessness, fornication, corruption everywhere. And as people died, their cries finally reached heaven.
And they were heard. The text shifts focus to four holy angels. Michael, Uriel, Raphael, and Gabriel. They look down, see the bloodshed, the lawlessness.
And they talk amongst themselves first.
Yeah, they confer about how bad things are, how the souls of men are crying out, basically saying, we need to take this upstairs.
So they bring the case, the cause of humanity, before the highest authority, the Lord of Lords, God of Gods.
Right, and they lay it all out. What Azazel did, teaching unrighteousness, revealing eternal secrets.
And what Semjaza and his crew did, the sleeping with women, defiling themselves, revealing all kinds of sins, they paint this picture of an earth just drowning in blood and injustice.
And they explicitly say the cries of the dead can't cease. And they add this interesting bit. They tell God, basically, you see all this, but you haven't told us what to do about it yet. It's like they're prompting the judgment.
And God the Most High responds. With specific jobs for each of them.
Exactly. Uriel is sent to Noah, son of Lamech, tells him to hide, warns him about the coming flood that will destroy everything, but also how he and his family will survive. It directly links this whole angelic mess to the reason for the flood.
Okay, so that's Uriel. What about Raphael?
Raphael gets Azazel.
Yeah.
He's told to bind him hand and foot, throw him into total darkness in a desert called Dudiel, pile rocks on him. There he stays until the final judgment. When he's thrown into the fire. Very. And Raphael is also told to heal the earth from Azazel's corrupting influence, assigning all that sin directly to him. Azazel becomes sort of the scapegoat for that type of technological and vanity-driven evil.
Okay. Gabriel.
Gabriel's task is the giants, the bastards, and the reprobates. He's told to destroy them by basically making them fight each other to the death.
Turning the violence back on itself.
Precisely. And they're explicitly told they won't get long life and no prayers for them from them or their fathers will be answered. Just total annihilation for these hybrid beings.
And Michael, he deals with the leader, Semjaza, and the others.
Yes, Michael is told to bind Semjaza and his associates. But there's a catch, a sort of poetic justice. First, they have to watch their sons, the giants, slaughter each other.
Oh, wow.
After they witness that horror. Then Michael binds them for 70 generations, it says, in the valleys of the earth. They're held there until the final judgment day, then off to the abyss of fire, prison forever.
So specific punishments for specific players, but there's a broader judgment too, a kind of restoration.
Yeah, the text talks about destroying the spears of the giants because they wronged humans, ending all evil work. And then this positive vision, the plant of righteousness and truth will appear. The righteous escape, live long, peaceful lives. The earth becomes fruitful again, cleansed. All people become righteous, worshiping God.
And a promise of no more punishment like the flood.
Right.
Blessings instead.
Right. Blessings will flow. So the core message here is stark. Angelic sin caused this catastrophe, and it required this massive, targeted divine intervention to cleanse the earth and punish the culprits.
Okay, so that's the judgment. But where does Enoch fit into all this before it happens? His role becomes really central now, doesn't it?
It does. The text says, before the judgments fully hit, Enoch was kind of hidden. Nobody knew where he was except that he was with the Watchers and with the Holy Ones. He's in this in-between space.
And the Holy Watchers, the good ones, they contact him.
Yes. They call him Enoch, the scribe, scribe of righteousness. And they give him a job. Go tell the fallen watchers, the ones who sinned, about their fate. Tell them they caused immense destruction and there's no peace nor forgiveness for them.
That's a heavy message to carry.
You bet. He has to tell them they'll see their own children, the giants, murdered. And they'll cry, but it won't help. No mercy.
And Enoch does it. He confronts them.
He does. He speaks to Azazel directly first about the unrighteousness he taught. Then he addresses all the fallen watchers together. And their reaction, pure terror. They're afraid, trembling.
And in that state, they ask him for help.
Ironically, yes. They ask Enoch, the scribe of righteousness, to write a petition for them, asking for forgiveness, and to read it to the Lord of Heaven. They can't do it themselves, the text says, because they're too ashamed. They can't even lift their faces to God.
Wow. So Enoch, the human scribe, becomes their only hope for intercession.
Pretty much. He writes it down, their petition and prayer. Then he goes to a specific place, the waters of Dan, near Mount Hermon, remember, where they swore their original oath.
Yeah, the place of their fall.
He reads their petition there until he falls asleep.
And he has a vision.
A big one. A dream called a vision of chastisement. A voice tells him to go back and reprimand these sons of heaven.
So not good news for their petition.
Not at all. He wakes up, finds them all gathered together, weeping in this place called Abel's Jail. And Enoch lays it on them, recounts his vision, delivers the reprimand from the Holy Great One.
And the final verdict.
Absolute. Their petition is denied. Throughout all the days of eternity, judgment's passed. They're never going back to heaven. They're decreed to be bound in the bonds of the earth forever.
And he reminds them again about seeing their sons destroyed.
Yep. Rubs it in, basically. You'll see your sons die. You won't get any pleasure from them and your pleas for them and yourselves.
Yeah.
Denied. Despite all the weeping, it's a final definitive sentence.
Okay, so that's the end for the fallen watchers, at least for now. But then the story shifts again, traumatically, to Enoch himself.
Right. After delivering this crushing verdict, Enoch is basically taken, whisked away by holy angels on these incredible journeys. It's like he gets a guided tour of the entire cosmos, the hidden structure of reality.
What kind of things does he see?
Oh, just incredible stuff. Places of flaming fire, mountains reaching to heaven, darkness. He's shown the treasuries, like the storehouses of stars, thunder, lightning, all the elements, winds, waters.
He sees the foundations of the earth, the pillars of heaven.
Yeah, the cornerstone, the four winds holding up the sky, the paths the angels travel. He goes to the ends of the earth, sees these magnificent symbolic mountains, one like God's throne made of alabaster and sapphire.
But he also sees places of punishment.
Definitely. That's a big part of it. He sees a deep abyss with columns of heavenly fire falling into it. And beyond that, this horrible waste place. No heaven, no earth, no water, no birds. Just desolation.
And that's where he sees the imprisoned stars.
Exactly. Seven stars that look like great burning mountains. Uriel tells him this is a prison for stars and the host of heaven, who didn't show up on time, basically. Cosmic disobedience. They're bound there for 10,000 years.
Even stars get punished. That says something about the order this text envisions.
It really does. And Uriel connects this place back to the Watchers, too, saying it's also where they will eventually stand, and that their spirits, loose on Earth, are the ones causing trouble, leading humans to sacrifice to demons. He even mentions the women they corrupted become sirens.
Wow. Does he see the angels' main prison, too?
Yes. He sees the prison of the angels. A separate place, intense fire, described as fearful and terrible, specifically for them.
But it's not all punishment and fire, is it? What about human souls?
Good point. He sees a mountain with four hollow places inside, deep, wide, smooth. Raphael explains this is where the spirits of the dead gather until Judgment Day.
And they're separated.
Yeah, four distinct places, one for the righteous spirits, and it has a bright spring of water, one for sinners who weren't judged yet but are in pain, one for those who were murdered, like Abel, whose spirits cry out for justice, and one for the really, really bad sinners, the ones complete in transgression, who won't even be raised or slain at the judgment. Just stay there. It's a complex view of the afterlife.
He sees other symbolic places too, like the Tree of Wisdom.
Yes. He sees a mountain range of fire, then seven amazing mountains, one like a throne. Michael confirms this is God's throne, and nearby there's this incredibly fragrant tree. Michael identifies it as the Tree of Wisdom, the one Adam and Eve ate from.
The one from Eden?
The very same. But here's the twist. Michael says this tree will be given to the righteous after the final judgment, transplanted to the temple, bringing joy, fragrance, long life. It's like a restoration of what was lost.
That's fascinating. A reversal.
Isn't it? He also sees a blessed place right next to an accursed valley, which Uriel says is for people who spoke against God. Again, very specific judgments for specific sins.
And throughout all this, Enoch isn't just sightseeing, is he? He's learning, recording.
Right. He's actively guided, shown secrets. He has to count and write down the stars' movements, names, courses, timings, all shown by Uriel.
Which feels important, given that the fallen angels taught a corrupt version of star knowledge, astrology.
Exactly. It's a direct contrast. Enoch receives the true divine order of the cosmos from a holy angel and records it righteously. It highlights that knowledge itself isn't bad. It's about the source and the purpose.
And Enoch's reaction through all this.
He's constantly blessing and praising God, overwhelmed by the majesty, the complexity, the justice of it all.
And the text emphasizes his unique position.
Absolutely. Enoch himself says, "And I, Enoch, alone saw the vision, the end of all things, and no man shall see as I have seen." He's presented as this singular figure, granted ultimate access.
So wrapping this part up, this deep dive into Enoch, it's taken us on just an epic journey, hasn't it? From that initial dramatic fall of the angels.
And the absolute chaos that followed the giants, the forbidden knowledge, the violence.
To the swift, decisive intervention by the holy angels and God's very specific, almost tiered judgments against the stars, the watchers, their offspring, humanity.
And then culminating in Enoch's incredible cosmic tours. Which map out this whole complex universe, heavens, earth, underworlds, prisons, places of blessing, detailing the fates of everyone involved. It really gives you a picture of a universe with strict rules and profound consequences for breaking them.
You've journeyed with us through Enoch's, well, pretty unique visions, seeing everything from those towering, flesh-eating giants spawned by angels all the way to cosmic rivers of fire and prisons for stars that didn't follow the schedule.
Yeah, it's a lot. So consider this. What does a text like Enoch, with this incredibly detailed cosmology, this dramatic story, pinning so much earthly evil squarely on angelic rebellion, what does that tell us about how ancient people, you know, tried to make sense of suffering, how they tried to find order in what must have seemed like a very chaotic world?
It's a powerful alternative explanation for the problem of evil, isn't it? Not just blaming humans, but seeing it as this corruption injected from, well, from the heavens downward. It really makes you think about all the different ways cultures have tried to answer those huge fundamental questions about life, the universe, and everything.
Absolutely. Thanks for taking this deep dive with us.